Hey, man. Hey, come here. Come over here. Yeah. You heard about Audible.com?
No.
Yeah, Audible. Audible.com,
What
man.
is
Hey,
audible.com?
keep your mouth down. Keep your
I'm
voice
sorry.
down, man.
I'm sorry.
Man, you can't let them hear you. Okay. I'm talking about 180,000 audiobooks.
How many?
180,000, Keith. Okay. You know what else they got? Spoken word audio products, or SWAPs, as we call them, swaps. The kids on the street, they're calling them swaps, man.
Swap, swap.
Yeah, you got any swaps, man? Well, guess what? I got an unlimited supply. Audibletrial.com/Midwestern. Oh, dude, I'll hook you up. First one's free, man. First one's free.
First one's free. You do that for me?
Yeah, do that.
What do I gotta do?
Nothing, man. You just gotta go to audibletrial.com/Midwestern, all right?
And I get my free audio
book? You get one. First one's free after that. Man.
Oh, thank you, man. Thank you, man. Thank you.
All right, hey, man. Get out of here.
I'll see you later.
All right, hey, see ya.
Bye bye.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 28 of the Midwestern Social Scientists. I am a psychologist, Dr. Kip Pietrantonio.
And this is Keith McIntosh, a wanderer.
That's how he identifies now, as a wanderer.
Yeah, just a cosmic wanderer.
He's a cosmic wanderer, also a man of the sociology faith. So, today, it's a good thing you're a sociologist secretly.
Because.
And not just a wanderer, because we are going to be talking about why communism has not taken hold.
Ooh la la, that's a big topic.
Yeah. In the United States of America, why has Karl Marx's dream not come true? Or some would argue it's a nightmare. Why is the nightmare? Why have we been saved from communism, right? Or socialism?
Ah. Rescued from the evil red shadow, the evil red octopus. Sucking its blood from the world.
That's right. So first thing we're gonna talk about to kind of get this conversation going was, well, first let's give a little bit of background. So Keith is gonna be starting his PhD in sociology relatively quickly. He's already got a master's in it. I have a mere bachelor's degree in sociology, so I have studied Marx pretty extensively in undergrad, but it's been a while, and so Keith's a little bit more familiar than I am. So he's going to be kind of taking the lead on maybe some of the history, and I'm going to have to be kind of have my memory primed.
Jeez, you put the pressure on all of a sudden,
you
doctor.
You are a man who deserves pressure. So
all right,
anyway,
turns coal into a diamond. That's what pressure does.
Oh yeah, there you go. Turns coal into a diamond.
There we go. Under pressure.
Under pressure.
Ding 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 da ding ding. Have you heard the a cappella version of that on YouTube?
I haven't.
Oh, it's delicious.
Really? You gotta,
it's great.
It's delicious?
Yeah. It's amazing.
What's it taste like?
It tastes... It's an odd way to describe it, but it seems appropriate to me. It's just like you hear it and you're just like,
yeah.
Oh!
It's God, like whenever they...
Damn!
You using that word just now is like whenever you hear something out of context described as sexy.
I hate hearing like old businessmen being like, "Yeah, this plan is sexy," or like,
"Yeah,
just,
it's a very sexy brand," you know. And I'm like, "What is that? What do you mean,
sexy,
it's sexy
brand?" That people say that all the time.
Yeah, and I don't like that.
Fetishizing, I don't know, something or other.
It's just inaccurate.
What is the one thing? I'm trying to think. What's the Marxist spin on this?
Yeah, I don't know.
Fetishization.
Just using human impulse to sell stuff, I guess. But
okay.
Anyway, okay. So let's go ahead and get started. So let's talk about just Marx himself. So this is Karl Marx. He was born in Germany.
He was.
He was a Jewish man, right?
Yes, of the Jewish extraction.
Jewish man, born
brilliant,
in Germany.
Brilliant.
Born in, like, isn't a place he was born called, like, Rhineland?
Oh, that may be true. I'm not sure.
I can't remember off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But he was born in the early 1800s, like 1810 to 1820, from what I remember. I can't remember perfectly off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
And so, do you know anything about his early life, Keith?
I think he had kind of a relatively cushy early life.
Mm-hmm.
I know he went off to, like, left home at a relatively early age, like 17, I think. Mm-hmm. And he was something of a, he got into some trouble. He got into some mischief.
Mm.
But ultimately sort of saved himself from going down a dark path through his brilliance, mm-hmm. and great intelligence and philosophy. He was a philosopher, yeah. and was turned on to a philosopher named Hegel.
Yeah. Okay. And what did Hegel believe?
Hegel talked about the dialectic, looking for opposites,
mm-hmm.
and finding a pathway forward through a conversation between opposing viewpoints.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So from there, he essentially eventually goes off to school, gets like kind of higher level degrees in what, economics?
Philosophy. Well, I think his degree was actually in philosophy, but along the way he had some kind of awakening, and in his awakening he decided the point of philosophy isn't to understand the world, but is in fact to change it.
Huh.
And changing the world deals with economics and right. deals with politics. So yeah. he kind of left philosophy and literature. He's very poetic in his writings. You can tell he could have been a novelist. He's very poetic, even in his economic writings. But anyways, he left the poetry, he left the philosophy behind
uh-huh.
for writing about economics and politics.
Okay. Okay, so Karl Marx, he's born, and then he goes to France first, from what I recall.
Well, he was a bit of a troublemaker, even in his mm-hmm. 20s or so. So he was a kind of budding revolutionary,
mm-hmm.
and there was a year, 1848 is a really famous year for being a year of revolution, where basically all of Europe, basically we have the Arab Spring now, a couple mm-hmm. of years ago.
Right.
All these different, is kind of a domino situation, and all these different countries in Europe had civil unrest. Well, the same kind of thing happened in Europe in 1848. I think literally every country, I'm sure with some exceptions, but basically every country had turmoil going on. And so he was kind of bouncing around Europe
mm-hmm.
and got kicked out of a few places. I think at one point he fled. It may have been fleeing Germany to France. And then eventually he had to flee France to move to England,
yeah.
which is where he spent most of his life.
And he was writing like communist, basically newspapers.
I mean, yeah, pamphlets. Kind of yeah, I mean, it was kind of the YouTube video of the era, a pamphlet, which yeah. you would then sort of, what's the word, just trade
hand out. Send around. Distribute,
thank you.
Yeah. So I think what's really interesting about that is that's really hard for our American 21st century brains to get around. The idea that like publishing something in a newspaper could get you kicked out of the country.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like think how crazy that is. I mean, just all the controversial stuff like every single day. Imagine if like Fox News said something like extravagant about abortion or something like that, and then they were asked to leave the country, like the anchor who announced it. It just sounds so crazy that would happen.
Yeah, I guess the modern world was still, in some sense, still in its infancy at the time. I mean, I'm always amazed when I read about World War I, the beginning of it, because there's all this talk about emperors and kings mm-hmm. and czars and sultans. It seems it's very much still an ancient world to me in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can picture people riding into battle on horses
mm-hmm.
rather than tanks. You know, by the yeah. end of the war, it was tanks and airplanes and poison gases. But even in the beginning, it was kind of an 1800s vibe.
Mm.
So certainly when Marx was in his heyday, it was a different era. And if you were a troublemaker, once again, a troublemaker, and sort of a threat to the state,
mm-hmm.
you just get pushed out.
Yeah. Well, and I think about the other piece about during Karl Marx's time, the Industrial Revolution is like in full swing. Like we are moving from what I think we in America would view as kind of like the Minutemen and like this proper gentleman society in America and like that to this like really gritty, like building machines, textiles and all this stuff that kind of led into the 1800s. And I think about like American pragmaticism
mm-hmm.
kind of really growing out of that, where we developed our own American identity as being like kind of we're like the can-do people
yeah.
as opposed to like we are going to basically copy England but be democratic, You know, we kind of moved away from that.
Yeah, I know there were two main phases to the Industrial Revolution. And the first one started, you know, as early as the beginning of America in like the 1770s and even before that. But it was pretty simplistic. It was just creating machines where you could exchange one broken part for another part to fix machines more quickly rather than needing to make every single piece unique to every single unique machine.
Right.
Just simple changes. But then, like you said, by the middle of the 1800s, there was kind of this other wave that came about where it was more about like railroads crossing the country and the telegraph wire, and things were really picking up. It was, again, kind of the beginning of our era.
And like mastering electricity.
Electricity, little things like that.
Yeah, the revolutionary things. So the world is rapidly changing during his time. Because when he's born, I mean, we're talking, I mean, America is, you know, like John Adams is like the president. Yeah. You know what I mean? I mean, we're talking... Very early, like Thomas Jefferson is making the Louisiana Purchase, and that kind of stuff is going on when Karl Marx is like a kid. And I know he's over in Europe, but I mean, this whole world is developing on the other side of the world. Britain is in the middle of their Industrial Revolution as well. I mean, it just seems like you could see where the thought of like, hey, everything's going to change, and we have to change it. And if you see all these people going from owning their own little shops to like working in these giant factories, it's sort of like now how we kind of look at like everybody's on their iPhones and stuff all the time. And like people, it's like, what is happening to people? Like, where's this going? He's kind of like this guy who's like, he saw that happening. All these people are going to these factories, working a million hour days for basically nothing, you know, and then coming out of it. And it's like, okay, where is this heading? Well, eventually people are going to get fed up, you know?
Yeah, so he was born in 1818 in the Founding Fathers' generation, but he didn't die until the 1880s, I think the very end of the 1880s. So he lived through the American Civil War and Abraham Lincoln, and I thought it was kind of bizarre thinking, when you read Marx, you read this expression, wage slave. He says that a lot, wage slave, to make the point that even though you're earning money, you're really nothing more than a slave, you're a modern slave. But this was always in a European context, and you picture people shuffling out of factories.
Yeah.
It's kind of shocking to think there really were slaves.
Yeah.
There really were slaves all around the world, especially in Brazil and especially in America.
Yeah.
So he was fascinated by the American Civil War, and you know, this country, we threw off the shackles of monarchy and free men, and yet this same country has slaves. So he found that a kind of fascinating event.
Okay.
He actually wrote about Abraham Lincoln.
Wow.
Yeah.
What did he write?
He was, you know, approving of him, but I think also sort of skeptical just to see what would
happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So basically, okay. So moving past kind of Marx as a person, because I think we did a very large 10,000 foot view of that. Because it's kind of hard. It's like, you know, I don't have his biography memorized off of my head. But essentially, the tenets of his theory, and you can jump in, Keith, as we go here.
Well, actually, let me just say one more thing. He, he spent most of his life in England, and it's tough to, you know, if someone is describing the way they see the world, one of the first litmus tests everybody puts to that person is, are you actually living your life in accordance to what you believe, you know? So are you just talking the talk, or are you also walking the walk? So you can't help but do that to Marx. And he met a man from the, you know, bourgeoisie named Engels, who had a kind of heart of gold and wanted to change the world too, but was rich. And basically Engels thought Marx was a genius and didn't want him, say, working in the factories, wanted him writing his brilliance, copying it down, studying. So he gave him money, basically not enough to be wealthy or to live in an extravagant manner, but enough to not be poverty stricken. So Marx basically was able to live off his friend's money. To some extent, and didn't really spend it in a very careful way. So, for example, he would have a maid at times. He barely had any money. He would have one pair of trousers. His wife's name was Jenny, and she was, you know, at home during the day and could have easily picked up clothes from the floor. But it was important to him to live in a kind of, I guess you would say, upper middle class manner. So he really had no money, very little, but he was set about living in a not pragmatic, frugal manner. He didn't live in a frugal manner, is what I want to say. And I just think that's kind of interesting. It doesn't mean anything necessarily. It certainly doesn't mean his theories are untrue.
Yeah.
But I think it's interesting to reflect on the fact that this guy, he was not a Che Guevara. He was not a Castro even. I mean, he, you know, lived kind of a somewhat comfy, or he tried to live a comfy life, even though he didn't really have the money to live that way.
Yeah.
worthwhile to, I think, keep that in mind as you learn about Marx.
Well, I think it kind of, you know, a lot of the critiques around, like, communism, socialism is, like, you're basically either going to encourage being a leech, mm-hmm. you know, off the government or leech off the system. Mm. It's kind of funny. He was kind of like a leech off his friend.
Yeah. He had a bunch of kids, too. I mean, I don't know in terms. I don't know what the sort of birth control manner was at the time. I suppose the Trojan condoms didn't exist. Yeah, but
probably just the rhythm method.
Yeah, you know, I guess, like, so.
Paying attention to the days of the week and days of the month and everything.
He had quite a few children die. Even in childhood, I think only one of his children, and I could be wrong about that. I think maybe one of his children made it to adulthood. I know he had one child commit suicide.
Whoa.
He had a lot of, he had a rough, you know, I guess life was tougher back then in general, but he certainly had his traumas. Yeah.
Any idea what happened with his son who committed suicide?
No, I forget the story now. I'd have to look it up.
Okay. Well, anyway, so going back, that's really interesting. Yeah, and the Ingalls piece, thanks for bringing that in, because he was kind of his partner in crime.
Too, yeah, so. Yeah. Marx and Ingalls are kind of like, I don't know, what's a good pair? Like Batman and Robin? Yeah. Tom and Jerry, there we go.
Or like Scooby and Shag, you know?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Anyway, that's my Scooby impression.
Scooby would probably be Ingalls, and Shaggy would be, well, he'd have to put on some weight, though.
Yeah. Wait, who? Angle?
Well, Shaggy's got the, you know, he's got the shag, so I figure Marx has the big beard. That makes more sense.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. You think of Scooby as fat, though?
No, Shaggy needs to put on weight if he's gonna if he's gonna really fit the image of Marx.
Oh, I thought we were going the other way around. Sorry, I misunderstood. No. Okay. Okay, so, basically, what happens is Marx says in a very, this is very simplistic, that essentially societies are like human beings, and they start off in infancy, and that is kind of like having a chief, or having like a having like a some the big man in charge thing.
Yeah, the big man,
like that, like, and you think of like Native American tribes, like way back, or Aztec tribes or something like that, as kind of being like, that's what he would consider kind of the early societies, right? And then it kind of blossoms and it becomes more formalized. And then that would be like the, you know, like the adolescent time is like the monarchies. And so from monarchs, eventually that gives way to democracy, which I believe Karl Marx kind of thought was kind of like the teenage years of society, where you are starting to this very key phase of it, which is making the means of production. Mm-hmm. Basically, in a monarch, everything's going up to the king, kind of everybody's toiling, there's lords, all the money is going uphill. But then all of a sudden we create this like money in the middle, which is kind of this means of production thing, which, you know, basically boils down to just creating stuff, like being able to produce things in a mass way.
He actually has a passage that I can read. This is actually Marx writing, describing sort of what you just said. Mm-hmm. He says, the history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles. Mm. Freeman and slave, patrician and plebeian, lord and serf, guildmaster and journeyman, in a word, oppressor and oppressed, stood in contrast, opposition to one another, carried on an uninterrupted, now hidden, now open fight, a fight that each time ended, either in a revolutionary reconstitution of society at large, or in the common ruin of the contending classes.
Yeah.
So basically, what I take from that is, while society changes and evolves from the earliest tribal communities up to the modern world, the way Marx sees it is basically there are two groups. There's Team A and Team B, which is the rich and the poor. And all society can be understood as is a competition or conflict or war between these two classes. Mm-hmm. And over time, it changes, the battlefield changes, the tactics change, certainly the dress, the uniforms, the clothing changes. Mm-hmm. But fundamentally, that's the tension that he sees existing.
Yeah, yeah. So that's kind of the nitty-gritty of each stage, is kind of the battle between those two groups, whether it be a king, the chief, you know, the president now. Wouldn't even be the president, it'd be like the oligopoly.
Yeah, it would like be the business owners.
It'd be like the business owners now. And eventually, the idea is that we are going to hit a mature phase where we are going to kind of overcome our basic human instincts, and we are going to say, this is basically bullshit, you know, this inequality thing. And what's going to happen is there's way more poor people than there are rich. They are going to rise up and say, no more, we've had enough, this is BS, and say we all need to be equal no matter who is doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, everybody needs to be even. And that a new form of government known as socialism will arise from that, where that's kind of the transition phase, right, Keith? And then eventually we move to full-on communism.
Communism.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, the basic idea is super simple. The basic idea mm-hmm. is the world isn't fair, mm-hmm. and we're all born into it. But it's set up in such a way that the people who are well off have no desire to fix an unfair world.
Right.
So it's up to the masses who are born into not particularly kind situations
mm-hmm.
to band together and take the shit over, basically.
Right.
And there are no rules. So if you're breaking the law, well, who says? Rich people say, because their law is one way or another protecting those people. Right. So we can break the rules, we can break down institutions, and we can build a new classless society where everybody is taken care of, and we all rejoice in brotherhood and fellowship.
Right. And I think the idea is that there's an, because of the all the money and the means of production, the growing middle part, kind of, there's now enough where everybody could have a good life.
Yeah.
Versus when, you know, when there's not enough food to feed everybody, you can't. But now we are at a place where we can easily produce enough for everybody, at least in America. Like, every grocery store is full of groceries all the time. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? It's amazing when you think about it. So we could easily produce enough where people could, you know, essentially, rather than getting money for my job, we mm-hmm. can all just do our jobs and go to the grocery store and get what we need, and there'd be no desire to steal or get more or anything. You know, because we would just be able to have it. Because yeah. the idea would be the job that we do or the job that we work pays for the other things we need.
Mm-hmm.
There's no need for kind of formal money moving around or anything.
Sometimes people will say to each to their ability. Yeah. Meaning if you're really smart, you're expected to do smart things and mm-hmm. contribute in that way. If you're weak, then you only have to do a little bit. So to each to his ability or his or her ability. And then also whatever your need is gets taken care of as well.
Right.
So everyone's needs are met.
Yeah.
And everyone contributes to the best of their ability.
So one of the I think the fundamental flaws that a lot of people make when they critique this idea is that if you make healthcare free, for example, then everybody's going to abuse it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that that lends itself to a pretty poor understanding of economics. So for example, the reason nobody's stealing grass is because there's pretty much an unlimited supply of it,
mm-hmm.
right? So from that theory, the reason people rip off the healthcare system now or try to like get as much out of it as they possibly can by paying the least is because it's a precious commodity, you know? But once a commodity becomes free and available for everybody, there's no desire to steal it, you know?
Mm.
And so that's what happens in a capitalist society is somebody owns like diamonds, you know, mm-hmm. for example. Even though there's plenty of diamonds in the world, the jeweling companies own them all. And so they don't give them away. And because of that, they control the flow of the supply flow.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially they can say like, oh, this is a very rare thing. And they can charge up the wahoo for it.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is if diamonds were everywhere, we wouldn't even care. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But so it's like this supply and demand thing goes on. So I think whenever we critique socialism, it's always like from living in the capitalist fishbowl.
Hmm.
We're like, well, if everything in capitalism stayed the same and all of a sudden we flip the switch to free healthcare, people would abuse it. It's like, well, yeah, but once you flip the switch to free healthcare, healthcare changes.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So I think that's one of the fundamental flawed critiques that people make often is the living in the capitalist fishbowl, critiquing a communist world. You know?
I think it was Albert Einstein said something to the effect of you need sort of a new way of thinking to fix like an intractable problem mm-hmm. requires basically a new brain or a new perspective than the kind of thinking that spawned the problem.
Right.
But that's hard to do, you know, to sort of think outside the box and
yeah.
come to something from a new perspective.
Right.
But that's kind of the idea. And I don't support, by the way, any of this necessarily.
Yeah.
In fact, I'll just go outright and say I don't.
Yeah.
Or at least a lot of it. But that's the idea behind it. And it's quite a laudable idea. I mean, mm-hmm. the idea, it's hard to sort of shit on communism as an idea
mm-hmm.
because it's all about, you know, everybody taking care of one another.
Right.
Mm.
Yeah. So, okay. So that's I don't know. Do you feel like we covered the theory?
Maybe yeah, no, I think that was for these purposes. I think that was fine.
Okay. So why, Keith, then, you know, did this not happen? Why did we not make the transition from democracy over to communism. Some would argue that a lot of European countries are well on their way. You know, the Nordic countries, Germany, where, you know, look at a country like Italy, where they get on average 43 days off per year. You know, it's pretty, I mean, that's vacation days, not weekends and stuff. So there's a lot of countries that are kind of moving in that direction where, you know, you're paying higher taxes, but essentially you're getting your healthcare, your food. I know some of the Nordic countries, like the teenagers, like, and young people get like a, basically an allowance from the government, you know? So some countries have moved that way, but why in the world, why is America not moving that way? Or is it?
Well, I think in a way the better question is why did other countries pursue a communist revolution? I mean, there are a lot of countries in the world that went ahead and went full blown in the communist direction, and generally speaking, by now they've gone the other way.
Right.
And I think the gist of it is it was alluring because it seemed to be a way of solving the problem of poverty. So if you had a country like China where you have masses of poor people,
yeah.
There's a great seductive quality to communism because you institute these policies and everyone's taken care of and everything's okay. Whereas if you're dealing with a rich country, I think there's sort of back to supply and demand of ideas. There's less demand for that because there's not a lot of people yearning for that. So I think for that reason, communism wasn't sort of appealing so much to, say, America than it might be as an idea to a poorer country like China. I think that's at least a start. But Marx thought also that, well, that's actually an interesting point to bring up because Marx didn't see it turning out that way. In fact, he would have seen Russia as backward and, you know, old-fashioned and absolutely not where communism's birth sort of should be, you know, in terms of the USSR and the kind of global powerhouse for communism. He would have seen communism blooming in England or America. Or maybe Germany, a country that was kind of a leader in the world. So the way it all turned out, in Marx's view, would have been, you know, he would have been rolling in his grave or he would have been horrified to find out how it all turned out.
Yeah. Well, okay, so why would he have thought that about Russia, do you think, Keith?
Thought that it was backward?
Yeah.
Like, well, because it was. I mean, you know, England, he chose to live in the heart of the world. He chose to live in London. You know, Britain was the seat of a global empire, and London was the heart of Britain. So he wanted to be in kind of in the belly of the beast and the heart of civilization and the heart of capitalism.
Right.
Russia at the time, and I suppose still today, but particularly at the time, it was still kind of in the throes of you had the czar.
Yeah.
And you had peasants. It was backward.
Well, but I guess I thought you said earlier that you thought, like, if you're there's poverty, it's like more seductive. You know what I mean?
Well, that was maybe a flaw of Marx. Maybe he didn't see that coming. Maybe he didn't realize that that's what would end up happening. I mean, he was trying to predict the future. He wasn't giving a prescription in some sense, saying, hey, countries like England, countries like America, here are theories that you should adopt. This is the next stage in evolution in terms of society. And this is the future. This is what civilization should be and will become.
Right.
And maybe he would have given a warning if he had known. He would have said, hey, if you were a country kind of further down the scale in terms of evolutionary progress, if you're still wrestling with a kind of peasant and czar dynamic, then you've got a couple stages to go before you graduate to communism.
Right.
But I don't think he thought to do that necessarily.
Yeah. And I know within, like, because I've brought that up, that idea up to, like, sociologists before, and it's pretty controversial on whether or not, like, Russia or China are truly, like, communist countries or ever really were, or if they were kind of like a bastardized version of it.
Yeah, that's really frustrating to me because there's no perfect scenario where these ideas can be implemented. I mean, you're wrestling with the ideas are perfect because they're ideas. They're just, they exist in the ether, you know, they're on paper. But you can't get around the fact that to institute them in the real world, you got to deal with the real world. You got to deal with real people. You will have Stalins. You will have the whole spectrum. You know, there are wonderful human beings that arise that are great, brave, honest leaders. And there are people who lie and steal and, you know, kind of like your Nixon, who is, you know, sort of corrupt and everything in between. So whatever the system is for society to work well, it has to be a system that allows for that whole spectrum of people. And a sort of historical situation that allows for that too. So it's really frustrating to me when someone says, "Yeah, I, you know, I, I'm a communist in some sense, or I follow Marxism.
Yeah.
But I don't think the Russian Revolution was real communism. I don't think the Chinese Revolution was real communism. I don't think the Cuban Revolution is real mm-hmm. communism. I don't think the North Korean Revolution is real communism. Mm-hmm. Every single scenario, they dismiss. And it's not that I don't see where they're coming from. I do. They have legitimate points. Those probably are not examples mm-hmm. of what Marx would say, you know, how communism should be implemented. But my take on it is, well, there's never going to be a perfect situation. Mm-hmm. So those are the best examples we have. And in those examples, one way or another, it didn't work out.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I kind of view it maybe just a little slightly differently. That I kind of view that every country that has tried to do it has not kind of met that developmental stage yet. Mm-hmm. You know, so like North Korea obviously isn't even close to like even a first world nation. You know what I mean? And hasn't been. And is a country that was birthed out of war, you know, and basically has sealed itself off from the world and everything.
It's a great example, you know? Because the Korean Peninsula for all of history has been unified.
Right.
It's an aberration that there's a North Korea and a South Korea. Mm-hmm. There really shouldn't be. It's one Korea.
Right.
And here's a perfect example of where two countries started at the sort of like the tortoise and the hare or something.
Yeah.
Like you can give someone a head start. But in this case, you don't need to give anyone a head start. They're at the exact same place, cut to 50 years later. They're very different countries. One country used communism and one country used democracy and capitalism.
Yeah. But that I think is a really like shitty example of communism. Like, I mean, that is basically a dictatorship. I mean, realistically, it's not communism.
It's an interesting point because every communist state seems to have that head honcho dude.
Right, which I don't really understand, and I think Marx would be very much against.
Yeah.
And then the thing I think with Russia that's always been like a struggle is that they went from that monarch to communism. And the problem that most people quote in terms of like what Russia couldn't do was there was these huge wait lists to get everything. So it's like you wanted a refrigerator in Russia, you might have to wait 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So people couldn't get things because they didn't have the means of production. They had no way of producing all this stuff. So there was kind of this, I can't remember if it was Lenin or Stalin, I think it was Stalin, basically tried to force an industrial revolution to happen. Mm-hmm. And was like, we're going to build factories like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is like they didn't have the money or they didn't have the ability. And then you combine that with American influence. You know, so instead of investing all this money in themselves, they're having to invest all this money into their ability to exist, so having to kind of guard against other countries. And same thing with Cuba. Like Cuba was basically cut off from much of the world because of America, you know. And so you've never really had this state where a communist country could kind of do its own thing and like actually have the experiment happen. As opposed to like having all these external factors really mess with it, you know, to the point of, I would say it's not really, it never really had a chance to germinate, let's say. But I think the countries where you have seen things kind of start to happen, and not in a revolutionary way, but slowly, like the Finlands, like the Norways, mm-hmm. like the Holland, you know, it's not called Holland anymore.
The Netherlands,
yeah. Right? These countries have like these number one in the world in healthcare, number one in the world in like life satisfaction, number one, you know.
But those are all capitalist countries.
Right. But they greatly, greatly incorporate socialist ideas where people aren't having to work like crazy. You're getting lots of maternity leave. Basically, it mm-hmm. goes against the American idea of like you have to be insanely efficient. You know, for everything, you have to work hard. You have to do all this stuff. It's like, really, you don't. If everybody just pays a fair share into the common mm-hmm. pool, you can provide a lot of things that make people generally happy, which is, you know, food, healthcare, you know, being healthy, happy, and wise, and education.
Nordic countries you mentioned are, they're like the best example of a capitalist country sort of moving as far as it can to creating what communism, sort of the allure of communism in terms of providing for the people and giving a good life to everyone. It's like as if they started like a plant or something where the roots are definitely firmly in the capitalist order, mm-hmm. but like the sunlight or something is coming from, you know, far over to the left, and the plant is sort of grown and strained to kind of catch that mm-hmm. sunlight or something like that. Mm-hmm. But my take on that is that they still are very much capitalist countries, and if they were to sort of make a jump, that may be their downfall. And the thing is, these countries are not, they are having problems. Mm-hmm. I mean, like France is a great example of where they gave all these privileges to the people in terms of maternity leave and, you know, the whole giant roster of things, time off, mm-hmm. A huge higher minimum wage. They're having trouble. They're mm-hmm. having problems. I mean, like, that's not a, that is not a, France is going to have to deal with their system at some point and sort of make corrections to it. Right. It's not a system that you can put on, not pause, but sort of, what's the word for when you're driving and you put your car in a...
Cruise control.
Cruise control. You can't put France on cruise control indefinitely mm-hmm. the way it is now. Yeah. It's it will require sort of fixing. And the fix will probably have to be reducing the welfare state mm-hmm. and becoming, you know, more of a capitalist model to mm-hmm. compete with other countries like America.
Right, right. But I think that the thing is, though, is, you know, our economy sucks, too. You know, and we are the epitome of capitalism.
We've got the strongest economy in the world, though.
I disagree with that. I think our economy, like, is leans heavily on, like, a few corporations. And if those corporations were to fall, like, for example, if GM were to fall, a huge amount of our economy would collapse. And I don't think that's a very healthy economy when it's leaning on a couple of major businesses, you know?
Yeah, well, I meant to say we have, in terms of the strongest, we have, like, literally the biggest economy.
I thought China did, was bigger.
No, they surpassed us in one dimension. I forget what it was now, what the definition was. Mm-hmm. They will surpass us. I mean, just how they can't not with the size. But, I mean, America does have the strongest, in quotes, strongest economy in the world. Yeah, I guess then if you're going to diagnose it that way, which is a legitimate way to diagnose it, then it's a bigger issue, though, I think. Right. It's like, well,
neither of you or I are economic experts.
Well, just like, these are the flaws of capitalism, that eventually power accumulates in a couple of giant corporations like GM or Merrill Lynch or Bank of America, and then that there can be problems.
Probably the most communist solution ever, save that, which is the government basically giving them money to keep surviving, you know?
Yeah, well, I think there was maybe in Time Magazine or so, there was some great sort of quote that said, basically, we're all socialists now. Mm-hmm. After the government bailed out the banks to keep America afloat,
right.
At that point, you can't really claim that this is the capitalist system anymore.
Right, exactly. So maybe let's move forward on why we think in America, like, why did it fail? It obviously has failed in America, or it's not here yet, which I don't like that argument at all.
No.
Like, I hate that, because that's so unfalsifiable.
No, I hate, right? I hate the idea, too, that we're still talking about this philosophy from the 1800s. I really wish there was a better, and I'm sure there is, but Marxism is so firmly entrenched, you know, especially in sociology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't think... It's for a reason. It's for a good reason. It's of historical importance.
Right.
And it still is important in terms of the idea of the haves and the have-nots and mm-hmm. class warfare. These are important ideas. But I would like to think we can sort of create the future by philosophizing intelligently in 2015 and not having to turn back to the 1860s. But with that said, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the future will bring. So you've been asking me,
mm-hmm.
why do I think that the communist revolution hasn't hit America, or didn't, say, in the early, I don't know, 1900s, I would have thought, if it was going to happen. But what do you think? I mean, why do you think that it hasn't really caught fire?
You know, I remember sitting in sociology class. It was like some random class where we had like a TA, mm-hmm. you know, and we were talking about Marxism, and I was saying, like, you know, well, how come it hasn't happened? I remember asking that question, you know. And I remember the TA had like a really smart answer, and he actually had like a study to kind of back it up. And so I can't remember everything perfectly, but it was basically the idea that Marx underestimated how much people love shit.
Yeah.
And so it's this thing where he could not believe that, like, the fashion industry would be where it is, for example, or the fact that people would be so satisfied from getting a smartphone. That, like, oh, I got a new iPhone. Like, that will be enough to keep me going to my job every single month.
Or the job that you hate.
Yeah, the job that I hate. Or, like, the big screen TV, you know? Which is, like, realistically just a way of getting media to yourself. Which media that perpetuates the idea that you should keep going to work.
Yeah, and really. Everything. I mean, TV is just sort of radiating commercials to get you to buy stuff.
Right. So it's... That, I think, is one of the big fundamental flaws. Is that people really, really get caught up in consumerism.
Hmm.
And the shift went from where we would buy like cars and appliances and stuff in the 50s to we spend money on shit that is blink of an eye out of our life. You know, we'll spend $5-6 on a cup of coffee, you know, that you drink, it's gone. And like, there's our money, you know, we're not investing our money into things. Yeah. We're basically blowing it on things that give us quick and immediate gratification. And I think that is one thing that stops people. So for example, if I get satisfied from buying the iPhone, for buying the MacBook, buying whatever, like that's where my brain is at work. I'm like, oh, I got to pay off this, or I got to pay off the BMW. My brain is not on like, this job needs to get better, or like I need to change something, you know. Yeah. We are appeased by these little objects.
Yeah, it's interesting. It makes me think about a study I read about in anthropology. Mm-hmm. Somebody was looking at the shift in agriculture, I guess, amongst early peoples, mm-hmm. from a hunter and gatherer model to an agricultural model where you are a farmer. Mm-hmm. And everybody just sort of assumed there was a kind of natural evolutionary progress or hierarchy in that transition. Mm-hmm. So basically we went from a rough world where you had to scavenge and fight and it was dog eat dog to a world of civilization where you're living in a village and you have a farm and food is readily available. And what was fascinating was that wasn't true. That's a really, it's like a cartoon version. That's mm-hmm. like a charitable version of the truth. Mm-hmm. And the truth was, people hunting and gathering are well capable of getting enough calories every day. Mm-hmm. Between the, you know, the berries and the grains and what have you, and a little bit of meat and a deer, they have plenty of food. And then also, in terms of tooth decay, I thought this was kind of interesting. Yeah. If you're eating food from all these different sources, I guess the bacteria in your mouth kind of balances itself out. Wow. And your teeth actually stay quite nice. They don't like rot out of your face, which is what we're used to.
Yeah.
Or when you think about people from like, you know, like George Washington, the 1800s to the 1700s. And then once people started farming, of course, they didn't have machines. So they're in the field all damn day in the hot sun, you know, behind an ox or whatever, tilling the soil with rudimentary tools, planting the seeds. If there's a drought one year, they're fucked. I mean, life is very precarious. So the hunter-gatherer works in quotes again, because you're just walking around, works, say, 3 or 4 hours a day.
Yeah.
And the farmer works all day long, like 14 hours a day. So like multiple times more. And yet the calorie intake it doesn't matter because it's sufficient in the hunter-gatherer, okay? And then also, when all your food comes from one source, which it would when you're a farmer, tooth decay sets in, right? So basically, health goes down and you're working a ton. So here you are pursuing a life of being a farmer, leaving hunting and gathering in the dust, and yet your life gets worse. So then people ask the question, obviously, why the hell did human beings ever take up farming?
Well, I think I have an answer.
Do you know what the answer is?
I think
go for it, yeah.
I think it has, and this, bring in some psychologist. So here I go. I think it has to do with certainty.
Okay.
If I have the food that I'm growing in my field, I am certain it's going to be there. Right? At any given day, I'm not certain that I'm going to be able to shoot a deer or like with an arrow, you know, or I'm going to be able to catch a fish. Mm-hmm. And if all of a sudden, for some reason, the fish aren't there or the buffalo ran away or something, like I'm kind of shit out of luck, mm-hmm. you know? So there's no guarantee of anything versus when you can grow all this food, like it's there, you can feel it, it's in your hands, you have control over it. And it's about human influence. And I'm not saying that's realistic. I'm saying that that's the psychological piece that's going on. You're right. I mean, probably like crops and stuff could like fail. But the thought that I'm in control, the belief that I am in control of my own food supply, mm-hmm. I think is what makes people want to move toward that.
Yeah, no, that seems really plausible. I mean, but like you said, I mean, obviously there can be droughts and everything can get ruined. And in that case, all that hard work immediately goes, you know, down the drain.
Right.
And plus, I think if you're, you know, hunter-gatherers inherited, hunter-gatherers have been hunting and gathering for tens of, maybe in a sense, hundreds of thousands of years, depending on where you want to draw the marker for the human race. Mm-hmm. But I think people were quite well equipped to deal with their environment. Mm-hmm. But in any event, the reason in this piece that I read was when you farm, you get a surplus. And when you have like a mountain of food, you can then sell that food mm-hmm. and you can make money. And with that money, you can buy shiny things.
Right.
You can buy shiny things. And mm-hmm. you've got a necklace for your wife mm-hmm. that your neighbor doesn't have.
Right.
And then your neighbor's wife ask him, how come I can't have that shiny thing? Basically, that's in the cycle of keeping up with the Joneses commences. So basically, the negatives of like poor health and having to work more are worth it in human psychology when it comes to having nice stuff.
Right.
And I can't help but wonder if there's a dynamic there still at play when we choose our iPhone and all our cool gadgets above.
Well, I think the going to, I mean, going to, if we're going to bring in psychology again, is like going to Maslow and Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Mm-hmm.
So Maslow would argue that we wouldn't be even worried about keeping up with the Joneses, which is like an esteem issue. That would be something that would only, we would only start to worry about after we had our food and our clothing and our safety and everything secured.
Your status.
Yeah. So it's not so much that we would be sacrificing it. It's that we're not worried about food anymore. So now what do we worry about? Mm-hmm. Okay. Now I got to worry about reproduction. Okay. Okay. Now I've got my wife. Okay. Now I have to, what goes on from there? Okay. Well, now I've got to worry about self-esteem and everything like that and comparison, you know, because you're endlessly, you're oriented toward growth. Mm-hmm. He would say. And so your brain is always worrying about the next stage. It's always trying to push you forward. And so if you have to have something to worry about in relation to growth. So if you're not worried about food and you're not worried about, you know, health at that point, then you're going to move to the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you'd maybe think that really rich people, you know, they're worried about these existential kind of issues and legacy and stuff, because they would say maybe that's like the last stage, you know.
As opposed to... I don't know, I don't
well, because they're not worried about eating or sleeping or anything, like where they're going to sleep that night. They've got all their medical needs pretty much met. So what do they worry about? Okay, well, then it's got to be, you know, we've got to be worried about like, oh, I have to build this building or I have to leave the world, like Bill Gates kind of stuff. Like he's at the point of like worrying about like, I have to leave the world without malaria, you know?
So yeah, I guess I think of that as being more like, that. He seems like an atypical person though. I mean, I think like that would be maybe leading to the communist ideas.
Mm-hmm.
You have nothing to do but sit around and philosophize. You're like, well, this world really is messed up and I've got the power to change it. So let's let the revolution begin.
Right. And that, we're talking bare bones minimum psychology here. Like you're always going to be moving forward towards something. Right. And so if you're not worried more about moving toward food, then you're worried about moving toward reproduction. If you're not worried about moving toward reproduction, then you're going to be worried about keeping up with the Joneses. Once you've kept up with the Joneses, where do you go from there? Okay, well, now I got to worry about these bigger things. And they're the ones that are going to give me the heart attack.
How does that relate, though, to Americans taking up or not taking up communist ideas?
Mm-hmm. Well, where I was going with it was kind of, you were talking about why people in the farming situation. I think we strayed really far from that. So we were talking about the farming situation and you were saying people were willing to sacrifice their health and everything to keep up with the Joneses. Mm-hmm. And I would make the argument that once they knew their food was like secure, even if it really wasn't, they felt like it was, then they start worrying about the necklaces and everything.
Yeah, I guess you can still have security in terms of food in both situations. It's just in one, there's an addition. You have two different options. Mm-hmm. In one case, you have like, increased, say, food security, but no shiny thing. And in the other, you have less security, or say less nutritious food, which you may or maybe you're not aware of that, and the shiny thing. And so at that point, then you go ahead and graduate to the shiny thing. And that just says something about human nature that probably also tells us something about why communism hasn't really caught on and why it's, you know, why it's failed and why capitalism, despite all the inequalities inherent to it, continues to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's probably the key, right? I mean, it's we aren't necessarily evil people where we don't care about poverty or we don't care about people going hungry. It's just that we are, you know, sort of animals that are calculating in a kind of basic way of what we value in terms of our own status.
Yeah.
And when you have the option of spending money on consumer good or a nice car or a nice suit that makes you look like you have a status or say giving your money away to somebody that you don't know on the other side of the world or in another place, it's very difficult to make the decision to pick that over the status.
See, I kind of disagree with the idea that we are like animals and all that kind of stuff in that way. Cause I think we've moved past that and we aren't just these, like at the core of us, we're very selfish and all we want to do is have sex and eat and blah, blah, blah. Like, I reject that idea. I think that, if anything, going back to kind of primates, like where we came from, they're very communal, you know, and they're very like worried about each other's well-being. And I think it's actually the system that we grew up in that kind of tricks us into being like selfish and self-centered and only worried about us, because we're tricked into thinking like we're all in competition with each other all the time. You know?
Yeah. I mean, the system isn't, there's no like, you know, evil imaginary system outside of humans. I mean, the system is completely a human made thing. So, I mean, you got to admit it bears the mark of us, right?
I would say that I probably disagree with the idea that there is no system outside of us. I think when television or something is showing us that you want to be this rich person, you want to drive the Benz, you have to own the shiny piece of jewelry, you know, that's the only way you're going to be happy, right? Then I think that's something that is perpetuated to poor people to keep them going to them jobs, you know, every single week.
Yeah, but I mean, one way or another, that TV was created by people and the businesses that, you know,
people,
put it in someone's home. And...
Right, and I'm not saying that people can't create a system that inherently screws over people, right? Mm-hmm. So if a few selfish people who are selfish for whatever reason get up on top, mm-hmm. and then want to maintain, you know, mm-hmm. their status, I totally believe in that. But I don't think that the average person is like drawn toward selfishness.
But you think that's dependent on a few bad seeds, a few selfish people getting on top and kind of pulling the puppet strings?
Of course, yeah.
But you don't think that, isn't it seem a bit like, I don't know, naive? Like if you were to kill those people and assassinate them, which is like basically the Bolshevik Revolution tossed out the rich people, it just seems in, you know, a generation later, you'll have a new crop of people who will fill that.
Yeah, that's the fishbowl thinking though. If you keep the exact same system in place, but you just kill these elements, yes, new elements are going to raise up and take those places. But if you fundamentally change how people think about their lives or how they think about each other, mm-hmm. then that won't emerge. Like if we punished selfishness or competition from an early age, those things wouldn't happen, in my opinion. But instead, we reward it, and our school is set up to do that. Like, who's the best in the class? You have to have the highest GPA. You have to. It's burned into us to compete from the very beginning. Versus, if the only way you could get to college was if you were the person who helped your classmates the most, mm-hmm. that's what would be ingrained. You know what I mean? And so I just don't. I disagree.
Yeah, I agree with that, but yeah. It's just that there's also like the competition seems like the negative side of a coin or something. There's another side to it too, which is mm-hmm. just trying to do your best and trying to be the best and trying to like get the best grades and so on and so forth. I mean, it seems hard to encourage an attitude or a behavior where you are doing your very best, you are going to the maximum, and at the same time, you are like helping out everyone else to the maximum too, you know?
Right, but I would say that the goal you're working toward in the capitalist system, like if you're working to get the best grade in biology, mm-hmm. you're not doing it because you're like have this passion about biology. You're doing it so that you can get through the next gate. Mm-hmm. So you're doing it so I can go to college, and now I can go to medical school, and now I can get money.
I agree, but if you didn't have that push or that you didn't take on those attitudes or values mm-hmm. To get to the next gate, would you perform more poorly?
Well, no, I don't think so. I think people would be, again, I think that's the fishbowl thinking. Like, yeah, if you just took away the motivation in a capitalist system, yes, people would still pursue passions even if there wasn't like this big reward at the end of the tunnel for it, you know? It just wouldn't be, it would look a lot different. You know, so people would still be interested in biology. People mm-hmm. would still create art. I think we see this in the music industry, right? Even though people aren't making millions of dollars, people are still putting out albums. People go into debt to put out albums. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? People go into debt. Look at like a class example, Kevin Smith, right? He went $30,000 into debt to make the movie Clerks. So I think even if the profit incentive isn't there, people will still pursue their dreams. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Do you have any examples of a country where you think that's sort of going on, or this is more just like imaginary what you want to have happen? Mm.
No, I'm not saying it's perfect either. I'm disagreeing with the idea that you brought up earlier, you know, about we are just human animals and we are driven to be selfish, and capitalism is like kind of feeding right into that. I think capitalism has been produced by very wealthy people trying to make us all into like the little puppet strings, you think you said.
Yeah, I guess to me, that seems to me sort of too simplistic and kind of childish mm-hmm. that there are these sort of evil people at the top kind of pulling the puppet strings. I think that happens mm-hmm. over and over and over again. But I still think like even they exist in this kind of greater human experience mm-hmm. and that's just sort of says something about human beings in general.
Well, here, how about this? How about in every society ever, there's been charity and helping people and like religious institutions where they've dedicated people dedicate their lives to helping people. Why is that, even though they don't have power and they're not on TV, why is that not viewed as like a natural thing that people do? Like, why is all these empathetic people who work as counselors, for example, who are willing to go listen to like sad stories all day, you know, for basically no money? Why mm-hmm. do they do this? Like, I think throughout all of society, there's classic examples of these altruistic people who exist, and that's not viewed as natural. It's almost like they're these freaks.
I think that is viewed as natural. I mean, I think like going back, like you mentioned, sort of chimpanzee ancestry, mm-hmm. and I think of like two things to it. One is the bonding that you mentioned and yeah. sticking up for your group. Yeah. And then the other is like going to war against another tribe. And being willing to like kill the other tribe right. members. And it seems to me humans have both of that.
So let's say we got two tribes of apes or mm-hmm. whatever, you know, two groups of apes.
Yeah, right? Bands.
Okay. And there's only one banana tree, right? Mm. And both groups want to hang out in that banana tree. Yeah, they're going to go to war for it because there's a limited supply. But I think if there's 18 banana trees and there's more than enough for everybody, there's going to be no reason to have war. And I think that's where we're at in America is like we have moved to the point where there is enough for everybody versus, you know, even 100 years ago, there wasn't.
See, that's I do take issue with that, though, because the reason there's enough for everybody is because of a capitalist system. So right. if you end that system, you can't be guaranteed that that'll stay around forever.
Well, I think that's the point of Marx's whole theory, right, is that it moves. We've now created enough stuff where everybody can have a good life.
But why did that come into creation?
Well, yeah, because of capitalism. But I think that's the whole evolutionary model of government.
But there's no example of where humans graduated from that stage to another stage.
What do you mean?
Like, you're suggesting then we can change now that we have everything. Everything is provided for.
Right.
So now we can move on to this next stage.
Right.
But you don't think that's ever actually happened anywhere?
Well, I think it happens all the time in little ways.
But as a society, as a country.
The society is the little things that happen, you know.
What countries are examples?
Okay, every church ever.
What countries are examples?
You're asking me a question that favors your answer, so I can't answer it in the way that you're putting me into a black and white yes or no, and I'm saying that I can't answer that because you're saying give me this example where an entire country has done it. Well, of course not. No country has done anything. Have countries moved toward that? Yes, I think lots of countries have, and I think lots of little things in the society show that people are willing to do that, are willing to sacrifice. People that could be million-dollar doctors have chosen to work in nonprofit hospitals. That's in a society that
exists. Those individual, but nobody's saying they don't exist. I mean, those individual people exist, but there's also mm-hmm. the cutthroat opposite of that for every person like that, and then most people, of course, are somewhere in between. But Marx wasn't writing about every religion. I mean, he was writing about a plan or a blueprint for a state to change in this way. So it's a fair question. I'm not trying to, you know, favor the answer I want. It is just an accurate question.
I felt like it was a black and white question.
So let's go back to your answer. You said every church ever. So what? Tell me more about that.
Okay. Well, so let me tie it back to our initial question first, because then it'll have more context. Our initial thing that I brought up is I take issue with the idea that capitalism serves how humans naturally are. And I disagree with that. I think humans are more blank slate. And I think you just kind of agreed to that. You said that people are on every side of the spectrum. There's the people who are obsessed with money and that's all they care about is like improving their own power, you know? And then there's the Mother Teresa's of the world, you know, who are just like totally concerned with other people and sacrifice their lives, or like the monks who burn themselves, you know, to make a civil rights statement or something like that. And everything in between. That's the only thing I was trying to make a point of. Was that I disagree with this idea that we are these fundamental human animals who are just as selfish as a dog is with food or something like that. I disagree with that. I think we've transcended that. That was my whole statement. I had nothing beyond that to prove. So
yeah, I think we are well capable of transcending that. However, I think it's sort of unwise to pick out particular individuals because, like, the bell curve, right, where you mm-hmm. have a few extremes on either side. Most people aren't ridiculously selfish or ridiculously charitable. I mean, mm-hmm. most people are kind of in the middle. So it seems to me to the best sort of, you know, to shine your flashlight on the people in the middle. Like, what are most, how do most people interact and deal with each other? And I think the kind of capitalist system seems more congruent with most people than a communist system, because the communist system demands a sort of higher level of morality, and you work, you know, to your extreme, even though maybe you're not getting that much. Mm-hmm. And my worry is, and I think it's probably true, but maybe mm-hmm. I'm blinded by the fishbowl thinking, mm-hmm. is that that's kind of permanent, that mm-hmm. communism, while a good idea, it sort of isn't a practical application for the world. So in your own personal life, maybe following the teachings of Jesus or some New Age philosopher, he might tell you not to litter and to be kind, and you in your own private life try to be, you know, a good mm-hmm. person. But in terms of a blueprint for all of society where the government administers these resources to you, and I'm not sure if that actually works. Mm. So you have churches that do wonderful things. You have NGO, you have different organizations that do wonderful
Habitat
things. Habitat for Humanity.
Relay for Life.
And those are wonderful things. And that right. absolutely is a part of the human condition, the part human animal. But again, that's like the good side. Yeah. You need to sort of look at the whole country, the whole society. And when I do that, what I see basically is the communist template has been a failure. And the capitalist template, whether it's more kind of capitalism with the gloves off in America, or whether it's more kind of socialist tinted capitalism mm-hmm. in Norway, that's the successful template.
See, I guess the only thing I would take issue with that, and I mean, neither of us are right or wrong. I mean, this is a really huge issue. It's about human sure, nature, sure. right? Yeah. So, I mean, there's no test you can really be like, there's the answer, right? What I would say that is enter your bell curve example. I totally agree with that. Like, there are people on the super capitalist, like Adam Smith, like people who worship Adam Smith kind of on one side. Yeah. And then there are like the hippy dippy people living in communes on the other side. Right. But I would say that the thing you can't ignore is that there is a group of people in the 1% of our society who have a very invested interest in making everybody else lean toward one side of that argument.
Yeah, I think that's true too. But I right. mean, you would think in a, like say in Russia or in the USSR, when you had a few human beings in a position of power because they were part of the Communist Party, they used that privilege to garner greater power and respect. And so in other words, you see the same dynamics at play in a communist system as you do in a capitalist system, don't you, or no?
Yeah, I mean, I would make the... I mean, this is the argument you don't like, but I'm going to make it anyway, is that was a really messed up system, and not like where the reason Stalin and all this had to do with the things he did or wanted to do the thing that he did was because of the Cold War and because of like civil unrest and poverty and not being able to get things to people. So his solution was kill everybody, you know? And so that's like one very evil person kind of ruining everything in that, you know, that he made the choice to kill these 6 million people or whatever, you know, 30 million people over whatever it was, yeah. you know?
Yeah. I don't see it quite the way. Plus I yeah. forget what year Stalin died, but there were many, you know, yeah. leaders after him who sort yeah. of kept it going and didn't, you know, act in that way. But I look at Castro, mm-hmm. Even, what's his name? Hugo Chavez, who passed away a couple of years ago now in Venezuela, Mao in China. I mean, it just seems like in every instance, so even in, the killing fields in Cambodia, mm-hmm. Ho Chi Minh, like every example, it just seems like there's that kind of head honcho dude who takes advantage of the situation. And my reading of that isn't that they're like evil people. It's just that power corrupts, right? And absolute power corrupts absolutely. So mm-hmm. when you have a one-party state, when you have a human structure where you've got one group at the top whose job it is to administer resources to everybody equitably, while you may get lucky and you may get an Abe Lincoln or what have you for, you know, a long time, mm-hmm. eventually you're going to get a Stalin. So you have to have a system that allows for that to happen. And I don't think communism does, because, you know, inevitably someone bad comes along and messes it up. Whereas democracy and capitalism, with its flaws, seems a bit more hardy, you know, a bit more willing to sort of change it. The fact that we can talk about American capitalism and Norwegian capitalism and, you know, France capitalism, and they have all these different templates.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's pretty powerful, that you can take this system and kind of tweak it to your own needs. And I think that probably, in terms of evolution, being able to adapt, it's a system that I think is more adaptable.
Well, and I think we got to make a distinction that capitalism and democracy are not the same thing.
No, but they've been paired up in most cases. Yeah.
But, I mean, in major ways, they can be divorced from each other. So, for example, if you are in a country where your healthcare is completely paid for, that eliminates a huge industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, there is no hospital industry then. I mean, there is, but it's a government industry.
Yeah, it's a different kind of industry.
You know what I mean, though? It's like not a, there's no profit incentive there. So that changes the dynamics of a society dramatically.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, China is the best example right now of that, where they've switched over to being a capitalist country. And yet, politically, they haven't switched over to being a democracy. It's funny, because the people in the West just assume the two go hand in hand, and that they're kind of inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
So China, at some point, will become a democracy, the thinking goes. And I think people in China kind of thought that too.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I've read recently, that's not the case. China is basically much ballsier and much more confident than it once was. And basically saying, no, like, your system is not perfect. And maybe this will actually work out quite well for us.
Right. Yeah, I think the other thing, though, is, you know, with China, there's it kind of goes back to your point originally about, like, there you have to deal with the real world. You know, and the fact of the matter is China has, what, almost 2 billion people?
1.3 billion.
Yeah, like, I mean, you know, and within the next 100 years, it's probably going to break that 2 billion, you know, thing. And if they hadn't done the one child thing, you know, who knows? But it kind of is like, okay, if we're going to do the communist country, probably starting with the biggest country on the world, like, as far as, like, distributing resources is really hard. You know what I mean? Versus if you were to start with a really small country that, you know, wasn't getting politically leaned on by every powerful capitalist country, you know? So.
Yeah, I guess you would expect communism to emerge in a kind of a, maybe like a Switzerland or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think in the place of that, you have the modern model of capitalism with a huge welfare state where people who are poor are basically taken care of and can still have decent lives. And I think that is such a stable and healthy system that there would be no reason to push it further into actually full-blown communism.
Yeah.
So I just don't really see any pathway forward for communism in the 21st century. I see just the capitalist model being amended to basically take care of poor people and sick people and people at the bottom, which is the allure of communism is all about that. So if capitalism can meet that demand, communism has no more allure.
Yeah. One of the reasons that I kind of disagree with that whole thing about people being naturally selfish and all that kind of stuff, because I think this is such a silly example, but I'm going to use it because I think it's funny. If you meet somebody who's homeschooled, they're just so different. You know what I mean? Or if you meet somebody who went to a Montessori school, you know?
Is that where they have all the different ages together?
Oh, no. It's like totally child-driven, and whatever the child wants to do, like they like learn about. There's no set curriculum. So if the children are like, oh, cool, like I'm looking at myself in the mirror, I see my eyes, I want to learn about eyes. Hmm. So then they're going to like read a book about eyes, you know? Yeah. So the belief is that children inherently want to learn and that we should let them kind of take it wherever they go. And there's a lot of places called like the Brooklyn Free School, for example. Every kid who has ever went, I think I heard that, I saw an NPR, or I listened to an NPR story on it. Like every kid who has ever went to that school has went to college.
Wow.
You know, it's like this incredible thing. And one of the cool things in that school is they can call any student can call an assembly at any time. And everybody has to show up. So they at first thought, like, is they going to abuse the system? But they don't. You know, they only do it for, like, really important things. Like, if there's, like, a bullying situation, they'll call an assembly and the kids will work it out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's really interesting. So it just shows, like, how incredibly powerful culture in your youth is. You know, that if you're, like, taught, like, from a very early age, like, don't be selfish. be kind. Like, you have to share. You have to, like, getting grades doesn't matter. Being the best, knowing the subject isn't the most important. Everybody getting, like, equal value and everybody being treated like a unique person is, like, the most important thing. You see that in people who grew up like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, and then you also see it, the people went to the private schools and, like, were born into, like, this upper class lifestyle and believe themselves to be elite. You know, they develop these uber capitalist beliefs, you know, so.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So I don't know, I just think it's funny. Like, yeah, so one of my classic examples, just homeschool kids.
Yeah, I knew a guy who lived in Romanian, and I guess it was a Soviet satellite back in the day, and he still experienced that as a child, living in a communist country, basically. And he made a point of just saying to me, do you know what it's like to be, like, incredibly bonded to, like, your classroom? He was served not in the military, but some kind of, like, military function, and all the guys were together, and they'd, like, all die for each other. That's how he described it. And I had to say, no, I've never experienced anything like that. And he kind of looked at me sort of knowingly, you know, kind of condescendingly, but he wasn't trying to be rude. But he basically just was making the point. I grew up in a way that you didn't, and I've seen, like, a quality to human nature that you haven't seen, and so I'm aware, sort of.
He's saying, like, a negative quality or positive?
No, he meant in a positive way.
He meant, like, being bonded to his classmates?
Yeah, I mean, the point he was making was basically, I came from America and I was, like, an individual and always treated as an individual and always seen as distinct from my classmates, but he grew up in a different place and had a different experience,
right?
And he had this intense bonding with the people he was with to the point where he'd, like, die for them.
Yeah.
And I had no idea what that felt like, and he you know, knows what that feels like. And that was all.
Yeah. I think that's what just gives me that little bit of hope, I guess. It's just these little situations, these little weird social experiments that happen that you're like, whoa, you know? It just shows how we truly do live in a fishbowl, you know, and you can't escape the fishbowl. You know? And, you know, even though I believe, like, going back to the, is Marx a hypocrite for not living his, like, he lived this decadent lifestyle, though he's poor. I'm not any, you know, I'm a big believer in kind of, like, certain elements of socialism. Like, I think we should all have health care. You know, I think we should all be protected. I think we should all have basic, like, food provided and some kind of a basic income provided for us. I don't think anybody should have to live in poverty. You know, I don't think anybody should have to live in a homeless shelter. Like, that seems insane to me in the richest country in the world, you know? But, you know, I don't believe in full-on communism. Like, I don't think that, like, we should eliminate ability or anything. And part of that is because, or excuse me, eliminate ambition, you know? Part of that is because I've been able to take advantage. You know, I've been able to go get a PhD, and, like, my ambition and my all this stuff has been rewarded. So in a way, I am kind of that bourgeoisie thing. You know, I have been rewarded by the system, and now I reinforce the system. You know, I am the bourgeoisie. That could be the name of the episode. I am the bourgeoisie.
Welcome to the bourgeoisie.
Yeah. So, yeah, anyway, all right. We kind of moved off topic, it felt like, a little bit. We started off talking about America.
Well, I think we got better as we went, because I think in the beginning it started off like, okay, we got to tell them about Karl Marx, we got to talk about communism, but then it became just a conversation.
Yeah, which I appreciate. All right, everybody. So I am Dr. Kip Pietrantonio.
And this is Keith McIntosh.
Arrivederci.
Have a nice week, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Hey, guys, if you enjoyed the show, check out Kip and Keith on Facebook at Midwestern Social Scientists. You can also tweet them at hashtag Midwestern Social Scientists. Or you can check out their Podomatic page, which is the first place the episodes get released. Don't miss out. Yeah, just check out their Facebook, okay? Thanks.